The Robber Barons, Carnegie Steel's Vertical Trust, Part 2, The Arms Merchant. In all directions throughout the world, Carnegie extended his markets. To Russia, Carnegie sold armored plate for their navy, and although a crusader for world peace, Carnegie exerted himself also to build most of the United States' big navy, sometimes trying to even trim the federal government in the process. In September of 1893, informants, these are former employees at the Homestead plant, which of course would have been shortly after the Great Strike, brought evidence to the Secretary of the Navy, Herbert, that the Carnegie Steel Company had failed to temper the armor plate evenly and properly. Some of the plates, after being randomly selected for testing and set aside, were retreated during the night, that is, re-kneeled and retempered. So that meant that the statements of the plant superintendents, Mr. Schwab and Mr. Corey, who submitted sworn statements of the precise time of treatment and tempering, were alleged to be false. In 1894, Captain Sampson led an investigation which supported all the charges, and the government issued fines of 15% upon all the amount of armor that had been purchased. Well, Schwab, Fisk, and Carnegie came to Washington, D.C. upon invitation and testified, but it was in vain. Unfortunately, Frick ended up saying that the uniformity in steel was unattainable. Ultimately, the fine was indeed reduced to 10%. So they had to pay $140,484. And 94 cents. Periodically, the loyal and secretive band of Carnegie associates would meet in strict conference, of which the minutes were carefully kept. It required unremitting vigilance, sleepless labor to carry the Carnegie Steel operations at the pace that they were expanding. By 1899, the Carnegie Steel profits were $20 million a year, and their steel sales accounted for 70% of all United States steel exports. At such secret meetings, all reports of the aggressions of new competitors, the combination in steel, political problems connected with protective tariffs, because in this case, this time, it's the United States that's being tariffed against, because Carnegie is, he's killing everybody in this country. You can imagine what he's doing overseas. And of course, they would then have labor questions that they had to thoroughly discuss and devise stratagems. For instance, a Carnegie agent brought news that the Chicago steelmakers were getting preferential shipping rates of $1 a ton less than Carnegie paid. So Carnegie countered by trying to break the railroad monopoly. He bought the dilapidated Pittsburgh, Canago, and Lake Erie Railroad that extended from Conneaut Harbor on Lake Erie to within 30 miles of his steelworks in Pittsburgh. He then completed the freight line to serve only his company and then connected his ore ships with the port on Lake Erie. Alarmed, the Pennsylvania Railroad offered Carnegie concessions, but Carnegie evaded them. Carnegie did call in a man who was in charge of railroad traffic matters. Quote, "I have to have the exact rebates that are being paid by our competitors. How you get them, I don't know, and I don't care, but I must have them." End of quote. Later, the individual, in due course, was ultimately admitted to a partnership in the Carnegie Steel Company. But of course, industrial espionage happened all the time. With the precise evidence, Carnegie now was able to confront the Pennsylvania Railroad and force them to cut their overcharges to his company by $1.5 million a year. Now, peace was made, but Carnegie did not abandon his spur freight line, which he renamed the Pittsburgh Bessemer and Lake Erie Railroad. This railroad completed Carnegie's chain of industrial units, which composed his vertical trust. It was almost completely rounded out by 1896-97. Such expansion was now imperative. It's actually a matter of self-preservation. Between 1896 and 1898, the large steel amalgamation in the West, which was created by Elbert Gary in collaboration with J.P. Morgan, caused a lot of concern for the Pittsburgh steelmasters. But Whereas the Federal Steel Company was vastly overcapitalized, they had stock worth $200 million, but its book value was only $56 million, so it's pretty heavily watered. The Carnegie Organization remained without watered stock or bonds, on which payments must be made with little interest to bankers, and possessed a cash war chest of almost unlimited size. The Carnegie Associates formed a close partnership of the old style, rather than the monopolistic bureaucracy as investment bankers were instituting in one trade after another. All the combinations in raw steel, pipe, or sheet could soon be made to feel Carnegie's competition painfully. He generally urged what is known as a policy of armed neutrality. If you didn't bother him, he wouldn't bother you, but if you pushed him, he'd finish you off. To meet the maneuvers of the Carnegie Associates was a formidable task, and Gary longed with Morgan's aid to develop the steel mills, that in order to come up with a grander design, he wanted to conquer the world market. Unfortunately, it was impossible to even gain a foothold at this particular moment in the trade, because Carnegie just dominated it. In 1898, with the Spanish-American War looming, Gary, Morgan, and Carnegie had dinner. Between them, they held 50% of the railroad tonnage in the United States. While people warred with foreign powers, the steelmakers made peace. Prices were kept high, and they made enormous war profits. But the real issue was, what if Carnegie broke from the pool? The future of Gary and Morgan's steel factions trembled in the balance. Panic would break loose. Gary once said to Morgan, quote, "Now if we could buy the Carnegie Company," and Morgan answered, quote, "I would not think of it. I don't believe I could raise the money," end of quote. However, he would indeed buy it. In 1901, for a little less than $500 million in stock, bonds, and cash. And of course, this is when Carnegie's foundations and philanthropy really kick in. Imagine that, $500 million in 1901 money. I don't think Bill Gates has the equivalent of it at this particular point, although it might be close. Now, the sources for this, The Robber Barons by Josephson, America in the Gilded Age by Cashman, and The Age of Moguls, The Story of Robber Barons and Tycoons by Holbrook. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out the CDs, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.